ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Friday the 13th. December the 13th, that is, 2019. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins as always, and it is a tradition. 2 weeks before Christmas, for the last 5 years, we talked to Travis Clark to preview the College Cup. Travis, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Should I just say Stanford men are going to win and then I can hang up and go home now?
We thought about the same thing. Literally, Dwayne's like, yeah, Stanford, right? I'm like, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, Travis, do you have Christmas shopping to do or something? I don't know. It's
fine. No, I just thought it'd be a good joke off the top to kick things off because, you know, here we are, fourth time in 5 years with Stanford marching into the College Cup. I would say maybe one of the years they were the best team, but, you know, here they are. They're probably third or fourth in this quartet, and yet everyone's looking at them thinking, well, can anybody beat them? So it's impressive. It's depressing in terms of, you know, taking some of the best talent in American soccer and turning into a machine of winning. But at the same time, that's what Jeremy Gunn's job is to do. So you can't really hate the player, maybe hate the game, as the kids say. Did the kids say that? I don't know where I'm going with that. But,
yeah. All right, I'll get deep and philosophical and sociological here with a question then. Stanford is dominant in the college game in the United States. There's also criticism in the United States that the game is a little bit elitist. Stanford's not exactly an accessible school for the average person. Do you think that's a reflection of who's plays the game at the youth elite level?
I think it's a factor for sure, but there's also an advantage in that for Stanford in that the kind of kid that wants to go play soccer at Stanford is somebody coming from a background that values the education and is likely to stay there for 4 years. You know, once you're in, you're probably not going to leave that early. You're not going to leave a degree on the table. I think Jordan Morris is the only one, the Sounders forward and the U.S. men's national team forward, to have left school early. Even somebody like Corey Baird, who is a U.S. youth national team veteran, spent 4 years there. So not only does sort of the – and I think it's too broad of a brush to paint it completely with elitist, but, there, you know, I was down at Development Academy games, and this is a league that requires a person to be of means where, you know, for at least many of the teams to you know, be able to fly to Florida and play 3 games in 4 days and pay for hotels. And I know that MLS teams help offset the cost of it for some, but some of those kids still end up, you know, even if they're scouted by an MLS academy, they've played at a certain level that requires a certain means. You know, kids aren't being plucked off of street soccer and going to play college soccer. That is relatively certain. There are obviously many exceptions. And when you're talking about, the NCAA and thousands of players, there's going to be exceptions all over the place. But, you know, broadly speaking, you could certainly throw that at Stanford and not be wrong.
Fair enough. All right, let's get to the task at hand. And before we get into the men's tournament, I'll let Kevin tackle that with his next couple questions. But let's look back to last weekend and putting aside the ethics of celebration in women's sport. tell me why Stanford, were they the deserving winners? Were they the best team this year?
Oh, yeah, by far. They finished the college season, I believe it was 25 games with 102 goals. That's over 4 goals a game on average, and the best player in the college game. I know that Jessie Fleming doesn't have the numbers, and you could make a claim that she's a better player than Katarina Macario, but 32 goals, 23 assists, it's really hard to quibble with that. You know, they had the top to bottom probably the best roster in the country. And then, you know, as listeners may or may not know, they beat North Carolina on penalty kicks after a 0-0 draw, which, you know, Carolina had chances, but Stanford was definitely the better team. They beat UCLA 4-1 Friday night. And I would say, you know, either UCLA is the number 2A team and UNC is the 2B team or vice versa or whatever. But, you know, you beat those two teams and or you get past those two teams, I guess, because you technically didn't beat North Carolina, but that's definitely more than deserving of their second title in three seasons.
The Men's College Cup starts tonight in Cary, North Carolina, with two matchups, Virginia versus Wake Forest and Georgetown versus Stanford. The final will be held Sunday, December 15th, in Cary, North Carolina as well. One of the hotbeds of soccer, especially in the lower leagues of soccer. That's where the North Carolina Courage play. That's where also there's been some national team games over the last few years. Cary, North Carolina, hotbed of soccer. But the College Cup tonight, which are your favorite? Or maybe I should start with this one, Travis. Who had the easier road to the Final Four? Who had the toughest road to the Final Four in the four teams playing tonight?
Oh, that is a great question. I don't, honestly, it's hard to really say that any of them had it easy. There's the claim that Wake Forest, you know, their pathway was they beat Maryland that had played on a Thursday night and they hosted them on a Sunday. They beat a Michigan team that had been battling injuries but had been pretty good for long stretches of the season. And then UC Santa Barbara was an unranked team. So, you know, you could look at that on paper and think, oh, well, that is the easiest one because they beat, you know, they had all games at home. But on the flip side, UCSB is a very tough team. They have a number of seniors on the squad. They came into like Winston-Salem and, you know, kicked the Demon Deacons around a little bit, and they are a physical team. So, you know, when you dig into it, that's certainly a factor. That could be a candidate. It took a moment of magic from a Canadian, Alistair Johnston, who won that game for them. And you could throw out Stanford, right? They're a 7 seed, so they had 2 games at home, but they had to fly all the way to Clemson for a matchup against the Tigers, who were the 2nd seed. I would say Stanford or Wake Forest, is, without getting really, really into the gritty details, they're probably I'm giving you two programs out of four as the answer. So let's just sit with Stanford because they went on the road. And they're the only one of this quartet that actually had to play a road game to get here. So I will settle on the Cardinal, even though, as we've talked about, they are pseudo-favorites at this point.
What makes Stanford such a dominant program over the last 5 years? They're the new Akron. If we look at Akron in the time of Caleb Porter, the time of Zarek Valentin, and the amount of great players coming out of this program, Stanford is the new Akron in a way. And I'm wondering, because it's more than one cycle, right? It's just a bit more than one cycle as being 5 years straight in the College Cup. Well, 4 or 5 years straight in the College Cup. When you look at their program, is it just a recruitment and they're able to offer great education and players accept to commit to Stanford a bit easier than other programs? What makes Stanford, their soccer program on the men and women's side, so dominant?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a lot of the things we've already talked about, whether the Stanford education, they can attract the best players, whether it's on the men's side who want to play college soccer. And then on the women's side, you also have that factor as well. The coaching staff plays a pivotal role as well. You know, on the women's side, Paul Ratcliffe does a good job. And it's notable, too, because it's very, you know, if you sit down and watch 90 minutes of a Stanford women's soccer game, there's a lot of possession, a lot of attacking. You watch a Stanford men's soccer game, while, there are moments of possession, it's very much we are going to be a well-drilled, organized team, and we are going to sit here and wait for you to make a mistake, or we're going to create, you know, force you to make a mistake, whether it's in your build-up play, whether it's scoring goals from set pieces, whether it's beating even a penalty kick shootout. I really don't know, and I think that has to be a testament to Jeremy Gunn, who obviously, you know, recruits some top talent. And for me, that's not to look at it from a negative perspective, but when you take that talent and then you ask them to do that, it's like, I've had one coach compare it to like a 4th or 5th division English soccer game, which I think is a little bit harsh, you know, but that's kind of what they do, right? They have a well-drilled group. They sit there and say, okay, come at us. You beat us. And then when you make a mistake, we're going to punish you. We're greater than the sum of the parts, even though they do get, you know, I believe the past few years they've been there, thereabouts with top 10 recruiting classes, getting really good talent. You know, this past season, they had arguably the two best attacking players commit to the school and play there. For who of the 2019 class that actually went to college. You know, Gabe Siegel from Bethesda SC over in my neck of the woods, and then, you know, prep school standout Semi Buddha, who came to the U.S. from Africa to play high school soccer. And so both are very, very good players. And, you know, it's an example of what Stanford is able to do on the recruiting side. Well, then, you know, you put all these pieces into play and, you know, you're a very good team and you're very hard to beat and they schedule well. And this was the first year actually among the stretch where they didn't win the Pac-12. Washington won, but UW lost last weekend to Georgetown as the Hoyas made their first College Cup appearance since 2012. So I'm curious to see how that game goes tonight, because the Hoyas have been one of the best programs, but coming up short, whether it's third round, second round, coming up short at home even. And now they head into Cary with a chance to, you know, really deep team, really talented team. But as you know, as I said before, when you play Stanford, you have to be at your ultimate best. So I thought they weren't as good this season, Stanford, even though I kind of expected them to be here, especially when they drew Clemson in the tournament. Just not to disparage Clemson, but it was sort of like the Clemson had this high-flying attack that kind of sputtered toward the end. And come NCAA tournament time, you can't really trust. You always can lean on like the defensive side to win out versus the offensive side. So I'm really curious to see how that game goes, and I know that I've wandered away from the question a little bit, but you know, when you're looking at Stanford, a lot of it starts with the coaches, what they're able to bring in, and then what they're able to get their players to execute on the field, whether that on the women's side is, you know, more fluid attacking soccer, or on the men's side, this never say die, never lose mentality that, and then paired with that, a bunch of very good soccer players.
Go ahead, Dwayne. I think we lost.
Sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, there you go.
Was on mute. I apologize. Sorry. Yeah, I try. Yeah, let's just try this again, Travis. A lot of people they only watch the College Cup. That's the only NCAA they'll watch all year. So for those people, can you give them a bit of what they missed? Who is the team or the program or the player that you're most disappointed that the casual fan won't get to see this weekend?
I just kind of bagged Clemson a little bit, but I do think that they played some really good soccer at times this season. They look to go to goal. They have some interesting players that could end up in MLS. Robbie Robinson scored a bag full of goals. But I think the interesting thing about this College Cup field is that you have a 1 seed, you have a 2 seed, and you have a 4 seed and a 7 seed. So there's not really this humongous lack of quality programs or quality team. You know, I think that, you know, even Wake Forest wasn't quite as good as it has been in the past, but part of that is down to just how good they have been of late. And, you know, they lose one or two games. This year they lost 4 games, which is huge for them, at least by their lofty standards. So I don't necessarily think that there's an obvious candidate that comes to mind. You know, Virginia and Georgetown are probably the two best teams at this point than have been throughout most of the season. You know, maybe somebody like, you know, the University of Washington, which doesn't play the most beautiful soccer, but it's similar to a Stanford a little bit, in that they have a couple of special players that can make moments of magic. You know, Blake Bottoli is a guy who unfortunately won't get to play the College Cup, but there's a lot of good talent out there that will get to see the field. I'm just kind of curious to see what, you know, how this whole MLS draft thing evolves this offseason and beyond, because it seems like the league's finally just saying, okay, you can sign whomever and let's just abolish the draft, let the kids have a shot if they want to take a shot. And I know that'll open another can of worms, but at the same time, it's something that needs to evolve as the league has changed as well.
I that's where I was going next. It appears that the super draft is no longer at the very most we might get a super conference call. Travis, what is the reaction to that within NCAA circles? Is this something that's viewed as a positive or a negative for college soccer players?
You know, I don't necessarily think I've asked enough coaches to really represent what they think about it. I do think that, you know, college coaches have evolved and changed, right? We've seen a spike in international recruiting. And actually, if you I don't know if you guys have noticed this at all. Maybe it's just me, but I think a lot more major programs are looking to recruit from Canada, specifically Ontario. You know, there's a lot of clubs there. I know it's always been like a little bit of a slow trickle, but you know, you look outside TFC and you have Vaughn. Sigma's been a player in there for a while. You know, there's a couple of other clubs that I'm forgetting, and you know, they're looking up north. They're looking into Europe, to South America. So international, I think there was a study put out by the NCAA that the percentage of internationals in D1 soccer, I think is like from 2013 to now, it's gone from about 11% to 19%. So that's pretty substantial in and of itself. And, you know, coaches are careful about, you know, recruiting from MLS academies, right? There's it's a never-ending carousel of players that commit because they want to have their future, and then they're either convinced or they decide to take the pro offer that comes their way. So I think at some point, you know, a player has to make, and I feel like I've said this before, I'm sure on your podcast, a player has to make up his mind what he thinks is a better pathway for him, you know, what the situation is. Because again, like, one thing that I feel like is overlooked in the United States, at least, and I know you guys don't have this same problem in Canada, you know, the cost of, it's not like these kids are all going to college and on free rides. There's only 9.9 scholarships per team. So a lot of these prospects have paid most of their way, or at least a chunk of their education. So I think that, you know, while the league has evolved in terms of like offering the Southern New Hampshire classes or whatever, you know, a creative team willing to invest, convince its best players to stay, should partnership with local schools and help defray the cost that way. I think the Seattle Sounders are doing that to an extent, but you know, it's a fascinating question, and I still think that about a player's best chance of reaching his potential is not playing in college soccer beyond a year. But I don't think the draft changes all that much. It's going to be similar to what it was. I actually feel like there are a few more players out there that could help teams eventually. You know, it just depends on the situation and the willingness of a coaching staff to give them a shot. But, you know, on the flip side, they're going to face long odds to get playing time right away and to stick beyond a year.
To finish our conversation, Travis, I'm going to throw you a curveball. California.
Ooh, curveball. Yeah, baseball now.
Exactly. Well, it could be a free kick, you know, a dipping ball. True. I'm going to send you a dipping ball. In California, there's new laws taking place next year, and some players in the college level and NCAA will be able to make a living off their likeliness. And it's going to be the case in a few different schools. Of course, Stanford, famously, it is in California, in the Bay Area. When you look at the new laws going into California and other states, and it will affect the NCAA, do you think it'll have any influence on college players going into certain universities to play a certain game? And is soccer big enough to actually take advantage of these new laws? And what do you think about the whole just paying the college players? It is 2019.
Yeah,
after all.
I do think that the law, the decision to make, is something that I think at the bare minimum the NCAA could do, because it makes sense for players to capitalize on their attention, to make a little bit of money. You know, take a Zion Williamson, for example. He raises the profile. He's a huge profile, and he can't make any money, whether it's from Duke paying him or just signing an endorsement deal. I don't necessarily think that'll have any kind of a impact on men's college soccer, but where it could have at least some kind of impact is on women's college soccer, because you know, take Katarina Macario, take a Jesse Fleming, think about Mallory Pugh, who could have, you know, she opted to sign a big contract with Nike to join the Federation's contracted pool of players. But, you know, under that scenario, she could have maybe gone to UCLA and played there and maybe developed a little bit more as a player, as opposed to jumping up to the NWSL right away. And I know that she's had relative success, but, and you know, maybe somebody like Jesse Fleming, and you guys would know better than me, like, would she, you think she has a big enough profile to sign an endorsement deal or something if she's playing at UCLA? You know, that I think is fair. And that would certainly, with the Women's World Cup and the Olympics, I think the women's impact on the game, you know, they're especially in, you know, the Canadian side of things, where you have a handful of players in the college game, that play for the full Canadian women's national team, that would, for me, have a little bit more of an impact. On the men's side of things, things are still, you know, there's not necessarily like a big enough traction for players to really capitalize on that. So that's kind of where I see it, and I'm curious to see how it evolves, but I don't think the impact will be massive.
Travis Clark, Top Drawer Soccer, thank you very much for your time today. As always, Travis, we'll come back and talk for sure when it's Super Conference Call time next January. But until then, happy holidays and thank you for your time today.
No problem, guys. Anytime. Thanks again for the invite.
And we'll be right back after this short break to talk more soccer with a soccer perspective. It's football, I know.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at @SoccerTodaySPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/Sports Podcasting Network. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. If you like what Dwayne and I and all the collaborators on the Sports Podcasting Network do every single day and week of the year, you can support us financially by going to patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. And for your support, you get premium content. $2 a month will give you access to the Two Solitude Soccer Podcast, where Dwayne and I dig deep into Canadian soccer from the Canadian Premier League to the Canadian Men's National Team with the Women's National Team and Women's game also across the world with a Canadian perspective. You can find that on the $2 tier, $5 tier. Soccer Today presents Breaking News Audio, Five Rings Extra. All shows you can find on the $5 tier and the $10 tier with a documentary tier. First documentary about the 2000 Gold Cup coming around Christmas time. And one more every 2 months to follow until June for sure. But Dwayne, when we look at the College Cup and the entirety of the college game, it has evolved a lot since we've started doing this show. Just the amount of picks by team that usually, at least back in my day, we should say, in 2014, 2016, even before that, you had teams drafting everyone and maybe just not signing them. Now teams oftentimes don't even draft people. Like, okay, I'll pass, which means probably a conference call next year. But where do you view the College Cup? And also, one thing that time was running away from us, I wanted to ask Travis also, the new MLS College Combine, or kind of like Showcase, it is called the Showcase, is happening also at the same time. What do you think is the landscape of the college game right now in 2019 coming into 2020?
Well, the combine that's taking place right now, or the showcase is taking place right now, is to replace the combine event that they used to have back in January, which served as a global scouting opportunity for MLS teams, which I think reflects how little they had in the past few years really been paying attention to the college game. Because the reality is that, and look, I've done the numbers lots of times, and maybe I'll do one final college super draft review that with my ranking system that I created about 7 years ago now this year, because it does seem like it might be done, just to illustrate the decline of the super draft. In the early days of MLS, it was very important. Just as, you know, as a comparison, you look at the Canadian Premier League, the U Sport draft was vital. There were good players that made those programs better, and that's because of where the league is. They needed those depth players. They needed those players to step in and fill spots, and there were lots of sort of diamonds in the rough, so to speak, that were hanging around there. But as, you know, that league evolves, I think you'll find less and less emphasis on that, just as we saw in Major League Soccer, because the reality was that over the past 7-8 years, at best, you were looking at maybe 5-6 players out of every draft that would have any kind of significant impact on teams. Now, you know, 5 or 6 that would have a significant impact, and maybe 5 or 6 more that would play a bit. So you're looking at, you know, they have 3 rounds of drafts, and you're getting 10 players out of that. And the production that they used to put on was just absurd. It was embarrassing, because, and I felt for the kids, because they're bringing them up there. They're having all their family come out to wherever the draft's taking place. They have the photos. They get all the media hype around them. You know, when I worked for MLS Soccer, all those players were available immediately on the phone for interviews. We did profiles on them the whole nine yards, and they didn't really have a chance, especially
they,
the later rounds.
They get cut 2 weeks later.
Yeah, and like, it almost seemed like you're setting themselves up. Like, you just be honest about what it is, and which it's a tryout. They're drafting teams to, you know, because they have claim rights, they're drafting teams to give a tryout, and it just doesn't seem sense to me. Like, as I said, there are maybe 10 players per year that are going to make MLS rosters and stick with them for a couple years, and four or five of them might be good. You know, you get diamonds in the rough. There's nothing there. I mean, Sebastian Endo for TFC has evolved into a very decent role player for TFC on a good TFC team, right? So you can get stuff like that. Nick Haglund, as much as we make fun of him for the trade, that's not his fault. He's still a decent depth defender in this league. He came from Xavier and out of the draft. So there's guys, but no one's gonna have parades. It's you're not drafting Connor McGregor here. Connor McDavid. I'm mixing all my people up here today. Anyway, you're not drafting guys like that. Connor McGregor would be interesting in soccer. I'd like to see that.
Sure. He's going to last about 2 minutes, get a red card, then banned for life because he will punch somebody in the face, and you're not allowed to punch people in the face in soccer. So maybe Connor McDavid, probably, but again, this sport is not played on ice, so I don't know. It's all relative.
Yeah, no, you're not drafting guys like that. You're not drafting.
But you
game
might
changers.
Though, if the system changes in the way Travis mentioned, where you basically just sign a homegrown contract to a player who's playing college or earlier, depending on your scouting team. If you find him first, you can sign him first. That could be a good way to go, and eventually you might have actually more players from college ranks eventually playing in MLS, just because it's not about the super draft. It's not about, like, the team would have been with him for a few years, and losing their eligibility in academies is something maybe the college system need to look at the way it is in Canada. But it's a topic for another day. Before we say goodbye for this week, Dwayne, let's take a quick look at the Premier League schedule this weekend. It is very busy in the Premier League from now all the way to January. Liverpool, Watford, Chelsea, Bournemouth, Sheffield United, Aston Villa, the Battle of the Cities, Leicester versus Norwich, Burnley, Newcastle, Southampton, West Ham, Man United, Everton. That's a juicy matchup.
Well, with the change, yeah. And United, of course, is on a bit of a roll, having won the derby last week. Everton, you know, has to get results because they're still in trouble. So, yeah, absolutely. It'll be an interesting one there.
Wolves, Tottenham, Arsenal, Man City on Sunday. That's going to be a tough one for Lundberg and Arsenal against Man City. And Crystal Palace, Brighton finishes your week of Premier League. The last one is on Monday. All games that we'll keep an eye on. What else is on your schedule soccer-wise this weekend?
I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and watch Sebastian Giovinco on TSN in the World Club Cup. That's going to be fun to have a little nostalgic moment there. You know, other than that, it's the holiday time. I've got my own tournament, the annual U Sector Christmas tournament. I have won that once in the past, so I'm going to look in for my second star. We'll see. I can't say the name of my team on the air because it's too rude, but
it's a non-safe for work type of name. Dwayne, you goalkeeper?
No, not this year, actually. Oh. I'm playing out for once. Give it a little try. Although I'm the backup, so I put myself there if they want me to go and goal. But I'm sick of being concussed half the time. So at any rate, I already forget to turn the mute button off. Imagine if I get hit in the head again. So
yeah, you're right. Tomorrow, Al Hilal at 9 a.m. Eastern Time versus Espérance Sportive de Tunis. One of the second-round matchup in the Club World Cup, followed by Monterrey and Al Sadd Sport Club at 12:30, both games on TSN. We'll be keeping an eye on these games as well, and we'll come back Monday, as always, to talk about the beautiful game, soccer, and the world football with a soccer perspective. Also, if anything of note happens during the weekend, we'll be there with the breaking news audio for our $5 tier member, and we appreciate your contribution to the success of the Sports Podcasting Network. Without you, we wouldn't be able to do what we do on a daily basis. As always, you can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Laramie, and this show at Soccer Today SPN live Monday to Friday, 11 a.m. on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN, of course. And the replay, you can find it on YouTube, Facebook, also Twitter, and everywhere you get your podcasts. Just a few minutes after the show finishes, podcasts are available. But as always, until Monday, for Dwayne, I'm Kevin. We wish you a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcasts.